From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Rape, Lies, and Audio Tape. Is the Weinstein scandal about sex or power? I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. Veteran Hollywood actor Kate Beckinsale has joined the growing list of women accusing Harvey Weinstein of everything from workplace harassment to rape. She posted on Instagram that the movie mogul propositioned her in a hotel room when she was just 17 years old. The accounts of more than a dozen women in the New York Times and the New Yorker have sent Hollywood reeling and inspired women to demand that men be held accountable for their behavior. But why now? And are we redefining our longstanding acceptances as to what is and what is not consensual sex, from college campuses to the boardroom? On today's Talking Point, a new bipartisan call for the U.S. to stop backing the Saudi-led military strikes in the devastated nation of Yemen. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The list of women accusing Harvey Weinstein of everything from workplace harassment to rape keeps growing. Why did Hollywood's open secret spill into the public now? Is it about sex or power? That's our main topic. Later on today's Talking Point, more than two-thirds of Yemen's population lacks access to clean water and sanitation. The UN calls it the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Now, a bipartisan group in Congress is calling for a vote to cut U.S. support for Saudi-led attacks. But first, this news update. President Donald Trump signed an order today that unwinds some of Obamacare's rules on insurance companies. It's a step towards repealing the Affordable Care Act, which has been repeatedly foiled by senators in his own party, including Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who was at the president's side today.
We're all gathered together for something I believe that's going to be very, very powerful for our nation and very good for a lot of people. And I can say when you get Rand Paul on your side, it has to be positive. That I can tell you. Boy.
Jonathan Cohn is following this. He's a senior national correspondent covering health care for HuffPost. Welcome, Jonathan.
Well, good to be on the show.
This is an executive order that calls for writing new regulations. So what does it do?
Right. So in a sense, I mean, the immediate legal impact of what happened today is exactly zero. It doesn't change any laws. It doesn't change any regulations. But what this does is it's sort of an announcement. It's sort of an order. He's basically telling the various parts of the federal government that work on health care, so, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Labor and the Department of Treasury, and it says to them, look, I want to achieve the following goals. You guys figure out how to do that within the constraints of the law. You guys write a bunch of new regulations that we can put in place, and so we can accomplish what I want to accomplish.
So it undermines Obamacare without Congress. Jonathan, does the president have the authority to change the law like this or to affect the law like this?
So in one sense, he doesn't. You know, we have a law in the books, the Affordable Care Act. It is still the law of the land. Program is out there running, like all laws, the specifics of how that law works, it leaves a lot of room for interpretation, and it's up to the executive branch of our democracy, the federal government, these departments we were just talking about. They have to sort of write the rules that sort of translate this program into a real on the ground program, and so what he is doing, and every White House does this, they're looking over and saying, well, where do we have leeway here where we can change the way Obamacare works so it looks more like we want it to, or if as may be the case, or how can we rewrite this so that it doesn't work very well and people, you know, the program falls apart, which is something we think is a terrible program, so we'd like to kind of blow it up. And that's basically what's going on here. They are looking for ways to change the rules of the road for health insurance companies in a way that would make the healthcare system more like what Trump and the Republicans would like it to look like, and in the process undermine, even sabotage the system that's out there now.
You've written that one of the most immediate and consequential parts of this order has to do with expanding flimsy, cheaper, short-term health plans. And here's how President Trump explained it.
short-term, limited-duration insurance. These health insurance policies are not subject to any very expansive and expensive Obamacare coverage mandates and rules. The cost of the Obamacare has been so outrageous, it is absolutely destroying everything in its wake.
So I have two questions off of that. First of all, is Obamacare really that destructive? And is the administration essentially saying now that cheap health plans that don't give you that much coverage can offer whatever they want?
So answer to your first question is no. I mean, every program, it's got pluses, it's got minuses, it's got things that are working well, it's got things that aren't working well. I think you can say without question that, you know, the number of people without health insurance in this country is at the lowest level ever. We know from data we have that access to care has improved. People are more financially secure. And then in many parts of the country, it's actually working quite well. If you live in California, for example, that market that's been set up works pretty well. That said, there are a lot of people who are paying a lot more for their premiums than they expected to. There's some places of the country where it's not working well, where the markets really are kind of teetering on the point of collapse. So, you know, and reasonable people can say, well, the trade-offs of the program aren't worth it. So, but, you know, this idea that it's this fiasco or collapsing is simply not true. The other question, you know, well, what are these plans like, and do they really, you know, what would they really provide? I mean, it's true, these short-term insurance plans, and just, you know, these are plans that you buy for a couple months, and the insurance companies will sell them to you, and they're really cheap. You know why they're really cheap? Because it's bad insurance. It doesn't cover, you know, all the essential benefits that you would get with a normal insurance plan. It could have caps on how much it will pay out. And, of course, they won't even sell it to you if you have a pre-existing medical condition. So, you know, these are basically flimsy insurance policies for people in good health. And, you know, it's a lot cheaper than buying an Affordable Care Act plan because it doesn't provide the same kind of protection. And if you were to buy one of these plans and you get really sick, let me tell you, there's a good chance you're going to be in trouble.
Jonathan Cohn, Senior National Correspondent covering healthcare for HuffPost. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
In a moment, Daily Show co-creator Liz Winstead talks about the Weinstein sexual abuse allegations on To The Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Hello again, I'm Jamil Smith, in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point. Harvey Weinstein was one of Hollywood's most powerful movie makers. Now, he's disgraced, fired by his own production company after multiple allegations of rape, sexual assault, harassment, and other assorted misbehaviors was reported this week in the New York Times and in the New Yorker magazine. Matt Baloney is executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter, one of the publications that tried to nail this story for years. Welcome, Matt.
Hi there.
What are the latest developments and the reaction in Hollywood right now?
Well, you can't go anywhere in Hollywood without this being the topic A of conversation. And I think the question is, how far is this going to go with both Harvey and with the industry in general? You know, Weinstein has left California. He's apparently now in Arizona at a rehab facility, and his company has been left to figure out whether they're even going to attempt to salvage this going forward.
So, Matt, the New York Times reported that the Weinstein company knew about the settlements as far back as 2015. Can the Weinstein company survive this, or is the brand too tarnished?
That's a good question. I mean, they are attempting right now to rename the company. And in that New York Times piece, the board member who negotiated Weinstein's most recent employment contract said that, yes, they knew about some settlements, but they thought they were for consensual infidelities, not necessarily the allegations that were in the New York Times and New Yorker piece, which the board maintains they did not know about. I think the viability of the company really depends on that question of what did they know and when did they know it.
This story has been, you know, quickly become about the statements and the recriminations from people who were not necessarily associated with these crimes. People like Jeffrey Katzenberg, who published his email. Is stuff like that enough? Is giving back all the donations he gave to, say, USC or to a politician enough?
Well, enough for what? Enough to allow Harvey Weinstein to have a comeback? No. I mean, Harvey is finished. I don't believe he will ever have a chance to work in Hollywood again. I know it's an industry that has a lot of people who have gotten second chances, like Mel Gibson and Roman Polanski and such, but I believe it is different. And I believe that the culture has changed in the world in general and in Hollywood specifically, that Harvey will not be welcome back. But for the industry at large, I think this has been a big wake-up call. And the number and the volume of people that are coming forward on this issue to say that they've had extraordinarily terrifying experiences with Harvey Weinstein, I think people are seeing that. And the hope is that this will cause people who may be in the position to commit these kinds of acts in the future to think twice.
Matt, what about the legal challenges that lie ahead for Weinstein? I mean, the New York Police Department is investigating. Apparently, the Associated Press reported that the London police are also investigating charges against him. Where will he go, and, you know, will he stay trying to, you know, run from the law?
That's a good question. I think the New York case is interesting because, you know, in the wake of Bill Cosby, New York doesn't have a statute of limitations on rape anymore. So some of these older claims could be brought up against him. It's a question of evidence and what kind of evidence they're able to gather, because people making statements in the media is not the same as people making statements officially to the police investigating the matter. So it'll be interesting to see who comes forward and makes those kinds of claims with the police.
Liz Winstead is a comedian and activist, the founder of Lady Parts Justice League and the co-founder of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Welcome, Liz.
Hey, thank you.
Liz, I want to ask you what you thought of the Jeffrey Katzenberg email. And, you know, are you surprised by his reaction and frankly, the lack of reaction from a lot of people in Hollywood?
I mean, I think it's sort of like people get brave when they see other people that they either respect or that can hire or not hire them come forward. And so for me, it always feels like the bravery is the trailblazers who came out before anybody else. You know, Rose McGowan came out knowing that it was going to taint her on every level. And look what happened. She comes out, she says her piece, she defends herself, and she gets kicked off of Twitter. So I don't know what satisfied means anymore, because for anybody or any woman who has worked in the entertainment industry, or really any industry who has experienced this, the full retribution or the full satisfaction of feeling like something happened to make a change hasn't really happened.
Mm. The power dynamic at play, Liz, in the Weinstein scandal is similar to other stories that we've seen involving allegations of sexual assault committed by wealthy, influential men, including President Trump. Are there some general truths that we can extract from these cases that about sexual assault or what it's really about?
I mean, I always feel when I look at people who are in positions of power who find themselves in these awful, you know, who become awful sexual predators or just serial harassers and abusers, the one thing that I see as a common thread always is that they're people who are not secure in their own power. They don't see their own talent, and therefore anybody who is talented or who has found them out or who could expose them needs to be destroyed. It seems to be a common thread constantly. And so for me, it's like, why that behavior is still so prevalent? Is it that people don't want to look at themselves and say, gosh, was I ever like that when I was in charge? I don't want to admit that about myself, so I have to erase that I see it in someone else. And secondly, you know, it gets very tiring whether we're talking about rape culture, whether we're talking about a culture of abuse in the workplace. It would be really nice to have dudes calling out other dudes to say, you know what, this is unacceptable, and I can't be in your presence, work with you, respect you if you continue this, because I see it, and I'm gonna step up against it.
I mean, you know, in full disclosure, Jeffrey Katzenberg's email, you know, in essence said, you know, quote, I cannot in any way say that this is okay with me. It's a message directly at Harvey Weinstein. It's not at all. And I am sickened by it, angry with you, and incredibly disappointed in you. That kind of scolding is, you know, I'm sure, you know, it's nice. And I'm sure it's nice that he released it. But Matt, I want to ask you, you know, about industry effect here. Is there a possibility that, you know, more accusers, more more women, you know, maybe not accusing Harvey Weinstein, but other you know, abusers in Hollywood might get encouraged because, you know, people like Jeffrey Katzenberg are sending these kinds of messages?
I think so. I'm curious others' opinions on this, but I personally do believe that more accusers will feel emboldened to come forward because of the shift in the culture in general and what we've seen with Bill Cosby and Fox News and some of the stuff in Silicon Valley and now with Harvey Weinstein, but also because you are hearing these voices out there of people saying, not only do I, you know, I didn't necessarily experience this myself, but I encourage others to come forward and share their stories. And I think more people will, because it is brave. It's super brave for these people to do this, and they need to feel encouragement. I think they're starting to get that in the culture.
Vanessa Gregoriadis is the author of the new book, Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. Welcome, Vanessa.
Hi, Janelle.
So, Vanessa, through your reporting, you've talked to a lot of young women, women who are approximately the same age as the targets of Weinstein's assaults. Of course, you know, he was targeting Gwyneth Paltrow when she's 22, looks like Kate Beckinsale at 17. How much differently do young women today look at sex, sexual assault, and the power relationships associated with both?
Yeah, so in my book, I spoke to tons of young women, and what I learned is the way that they look at sex is completely different than the way a Gen Xer or a boomer might look at sex. What they're trying to say is, these are our bodies, you need consent for anything, really, any sort of minor assault. I mean, you know, Harvey Weinstein, in a lot of ways, is an outlier here. And what we're really talking about is a broadening definition of sexual assault. Like, they just won't accept anymore that rape means a victim has a gun held to her head. You know, they want this broad definition that includes all manner of disrespectful, aggressive behavior. And what they're watching now with these stars like Angelina Jolie or Gwyneth Paltrow coming out and saying, I'm not ashamed and I'm going to say what he did to me, is really meaningful. I mean, they now have these kind of icons that they already emulate, saying, like, there should be no more shame around this for women. And it is brave and courageous to speak out.
Liz, what's your take on that? And, you know, and whether or not you think the entertainment industry is particularly prone to sexual harassment?
I mean, I think every industry has its place. I think if there's a patriarchal structure in place, it's going to be prone to adhering to that structure and not being receptive to hearing how that structure should change. I think the people who should be answering the question of, do you feel safer now to come forward, are people who have experienced it. I think we can go on, and when powerful people come out and say that, yeah, it's really great that you have come out after you have attained your power, but what about the people who are still living in it? What about the person who's just starting out? As you pointed out, 22-year-old, 17-year-old, what is those people's power? What is those people's idea for what that means in their career and what it means for anything that has to do with actually not having retribution? If you were to sit women down and take a poll and say, do you feel safe coming forward right now, talking about either sexual harassment against you in your workplace or hostile work environment in your workplace? Do you feel like you would have retribution against you? I think it would be a different answer than the one conversation we're having right now.
Matt, I want to ask you again about the media silence issue. NBC News, you know, employs Ronan Farrow as a contributor, and he brought the story to them, and yet they, you know, essentially said that it wasn't reportable, what have you. What do you think the repercussions are for that? And, you know, the press trying to get this story right has been a longstanding challenge. What do you think can come out of that?
Yeah, it's an interesting issue because I think there's some debate as to whether it was reportable. NBC has said that it wasn't at the time that Ronan Farrow had the story there and that it subsequently became a bigger and better story at The New Yorker. But there are other reports suggesting that they were skittish about this and didn't want to break this story. And, you know, as someone who has chased this story in the past and been unable to get anyone on the record to talk about Harvey Weinstein in this way, I find that very disappointing. I think that you, you know, if you have people on the record and their stories are verified, that's a good story. And it seems like they had the audio of the police incident as well. And that on its own is a very good story. And we would have definitely run that story had we had that. So kudos to Ronan Farrow for getting it out there. And again, we don't know exactly what happened, and I don't want to pass judgment on NBC because perhaps they didn't have the story. But anyone who had this story and didn't run it, that's a big fail.
There's, again, you know, this kind of misunderstanding of sexual assault is pretty broad. And, you know, someone who was a rape crisis counselor in college, I understand it from the ground level. Vanessa, I wanted to ask you, in your research on college campuses, you found these blurry lines around sexual consent. Are those rules being rewritten even before they're really firmly defined?
Oh, on college campuses today, the rules are being rewritten from scratch. So, you know, with Harvey Weinstein, there was obviously a power differential. He was a massive, you know, one of the biggest producers of our era of prestige films. And these are young ingenues whose lives have been devoted to this moment, to getting this man's attention. Right. But what's happening on college campuses is a bit different and almost in some ways more profound, because in states like California, all the Ivy Leagues, many other state universities, universities are trying to tell their students, you know what, let's try to change standards for consensual sex. Let's try to understand that no means no is no longer in effect as for young adults in America. You need to get a yes for consensual sex. You need to, I mean, if Harvey Weinstein, he never would have done this, right? Mm. But if he had stopped for a moment and said to these women, do you want to do this? They would all have said no, right?
A lot of them did.
So I support, right, well, they sure did, yeah. I mean, listening to that tape is absolutely chilling, to hear a predator at work, right? Not taking no for an answer. But I think this question of do you want to do this for kind of one-night stands and hookups and any sort of weird, you know, sexual thing that may happen at a bar is a really important question. And we can shift the standard for consensual sex right there. That's what colleges are doing today. And that's what I hope rolls out across America, because I think we're going to get a lot of women who will not say yes. Mm-hmm. And that will, it will really change women's feeling of being pressured and coerced into sex.
All right. Well, thank you. We're going to continue the conversation. Thank you to Matt Bellany, who has to leave us. We're going to take a brief break and continue later on today's Talking Point, a new bipartisan call for the U.S. to stop backing the Saudi-led military strikes in the devastated nation of Yemen. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Jamil Smith back with To The Point. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about sex, power, and whether there's a growing culture of accountability when it comes to rape and harassment in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal. Does it go beyond Hollywood? With me, our Daily Show co-founder Liz Winstead, now of the Lady Parts Justice League, and journalist Vanessa Gregoriadis, author of a new book, Blurred Lines, that deals with sexual assault on college campuses. And joining us now is Laura Kipnis, professor of film studies at Northwestern University and the author of Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Welcome, Laura.
Hi.
Laura, we've been talking about how attitudes about sex and sexual violence shape how we look at this Weinstein scandal and others like it. And so I would like to get first your thoughts on the Weinstein allegations and whether there are some important truths that we should draw from them.
Oh, definitely. And I have to say, as a feminist, this story gives me political optimism because it's not just Weinstein that we're talking about here. You know, we've seen a series of, you know, media titans falling suddenly, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, you know, people who once looked impervious and whose power looked, you know, untouchable, suddenly, you know, falling, their careers crumbling overnight. And I do think that it's a sign that these power relations and forms of sexual privilege are being, you know, not just renegotiated, but, you know, toppled. So I think something else that we're seeing, and I think Liz said something great, that we're seeing at some level how pathetic these figures are. They're not just all powerful, but that the forms of power and their sort of sexual compulsions are also compensatory. You know, at heart, there's a sort of self-loathing. There's these desires to compensate for something and so to act in what ultimately are these ways that bring them down. So I think it's a great lesson for all of us, but for women especially, that male power isn't something, you know, insurmountable, that it's got these, you know, it's subject to falling in the same way that, you know, colonialism once fell or the Soviet Union once fell.
Mm-hmm. Liz, you mentioned earlier that men need to take the lead and start speaking up a lot more about this. What do you think men... You know, what clue are they going to have to get at this point? I mean, we've seen so many of these scandals, and yet we still see men saying that, you know, they only care, you know, when they're because they have a daughter or things like that. We see them kind of going to the same tropes. What do you think men need to hear in order to actually be helpful?
I mean, I don't even think it's that what do men need to hear? It's that at some point men need to recognize that if they are indeed interested and advocates for social justice, racial justice, human rights, that they have to advocate for the humanity of women and that they have to realize that the humanity of women will make their workplace better, their relationships better, and also make them actually consistent, authentic humans that we can trust. Because the same thing, while I agree that I feel like this is a great stride for feminism and for women, I'm still stuck on the fact that the reason that these powerful men are coming down, it wasn't because two women said so or five women said so. Each of these cases, whether we're talking about Cosby or Roger Ailes or Harvey Weinstein, it is Bill O'Reilly, it's double-digit amounts of women that needed to come forward. And the second part is that the bottom line of each of these companies was threatened. And if the bottom line and financial bottom line of all of these companies had not been threatened, I don't know where we would be. We're begging the whole board to resign from Miramax or from the Weinstein Company right now. And so, you know, it's when things like that happen, that always just gives me pause. I feel like, yes, it is really important, but I also feel like, yes, why is it that so many women have to come forward before we believe women?
Vanessa, I want to ask you a little bit about the new, I guess, revised guidance that Education Secretary Betsy DeVos issued recently concerning, you know, adjudicating cases of sexual assault on campus, basically reversing the 2011 Dear Colleague letter that Obama's Education Department had issued. In light of the Weinstein scandal, are there lessons for colleges that are struggling with how to deal with this?
Sure. I mean, Betsy DeVos basically wants to cut off the campus courts at the knees. I think that the Weinstein, you know, this epic story of 20 years of reporters trying to make something stick and women being so fearful of coming forward shows that women who go to campus courts, and I'm not saying there aren't some bad actors out there, and I'm not saying that some of the college cases are not problematic, but largely women who are going to step forward, college women, and go to their administrators and retell some sort of sexual escapade that happened that they believe were non-consensual should actually perhaps be given the benefit of the doubt, perhaps should be given a little bit of a leg up, which is what Obama was trying to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, DeVos has been not only clear that she does not believe that these campus courts are working, but her deputy told the New York Times that she thinks 90% of the cases in there are bogus and are just about we were both drunk. And she was outraged that in most of these cases, there's not even an allegation, quote, that the young man overrode the will of the young woman. So I think we can assume, yeah, that DeVos and the people who are working for her may be coming at the sexual assault issue from a really old perspective. You know, we didn't ask Gwyneth Paltrow, did you kick, did you hit, did you scream, did he override your will? We're not asking women that today, and that should not come into the picture.
Liz, I want to ask you your response about the what, you know, Secretary DeVos has been doing and saying, and what effect do you think it might have on rape culture in general?
Well, you know, and for me, you know, as we look at what is happening, you know, the thing that we don't talk about, I think, or that Betsy DeVos is ignoring, is the fact that if we're trying to expand our full liberation, as sexual beings, it's not only that no means no, it's that silence means no. If I am passed out and someone is having sex with me, you know, we don't recognize that. And now when we have the administration saying things like, we want to expand moral and religious exemptions for birth control, that is saying we have not accepted what it means to be a free and sexual woman in campus culture, in culture in general. Therefore, we still can default to blaming a woman. If Betsy DeVos believes that 90% of these cases are bogus, that says that she believes that women are asking for it on some level. And so when you add to it access to being able to expand your entire sexual being and having that be a safe place, we're not even having policies that allow that either. So I feel like the step backwards is huge, and it's really terrifying to me that we have somebody who is setting up and redefining what our education policy looks like when it's regard to Title IX, just as though our HHS is redefining what it means for sexuality and birth control. And I think that this puritanical way that we look at women as sexual beings is adding, not helping us with rape culture.
Laura, I know that you essentially had a personal crusade against the expanded Title IX policies in 2011 that the Obama administration put forth. Why did, you know, you feel so strongly about it? And, you know, are you concerned that we're going to see, you know, some kind of negative effects from not just, you know, what has already been, transpired under that Obama guidance, but now under this new revised DeVos guidance?
Well, I felt strongly about it because I was brought up on Title IX complaints myself for writing an article. I have to say that I think it's incredibly wrongheaded to compare the situation with Harvey Weinstein with the situation on campus. And that's part of the problem is we jump to these assumptions and make these very easy comparisons. I mean, with Harvey Weinstein, you're talking about like an asymmetrical power relation. The situations that are being adjudicated for the most part on campus are between peers. You know, they're between usually male and female students. And I don't think that what Candace Jackson said was that those 90% of, you know, cases that involve alcohol and people, you know, being blotto drunk and having sex, I don't think she said they were bogus cases. She was trying to talk about the particulars of the situation and what is actually happening and what's later, you know, being presented as non-consensual sex and, you know, being left to Title IX officers to adjudicate. So I just think we need more analysis and smarter analysis about what's actually happening in these situations before we leap to make policy.
And the policies that were in place under the Obama rules have just been, I mean, vastly expanded reach and redefinition of what is sexual assault that's all happening behind closed doors. I mean, to the point that I could be brought up on these charges for writing an article.
Liz, I would love to get your response to that.
Well, first of all, I don't know that the peer situation happens when you have football teams who are generating lots of dollars on campuses and football players engaged in sexual assault. That is a smaller parallel, but it's somebody who is part of a power structure and part of a systematic power structure within an institution that people want to protect. So to not make a parallel, I think is foolish. And I also think, too, that it feels to me like trying to act like somebody would bring forth these charges when that is just simply not proven for no reason at all. It benefits you not at all. To get justice at all in any kind of sexual assault charge is nearly impossible. And it's nearly impossible. And for you to do it, the amount of times that you have to relive your experience to even be heard is something that we really need to look at when we make these blatant statements about how many of these cases are looked at or put into question. I just feel like it's very dangerous.
Vanessa, I know there's a different power dynamic that you address in the book, and that is fraternities. Certainly there's a certain power dynamic at play whenever there's a fraternity party and these kinds of events. And, you know, certainly when they could lead to potential sexual violence. I know that, you know, I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently about my experience as a rape crisis counselor, you know, basically giving seminars to these fraternity members and trying to educate them about sexual assault and consent. But should sexual harassment education start at an earlier age in college? And what is your argument about fraternities specifically?
Well, I mean, look, I agree with Laura that, you know, the Harvey experience, we the parallel to what's going on campus, which to me, in my research, what I found is that, you know, the early sexual experience of Americans that are happening at college, you know, most of us form our sexual identities at college. So often those are having, you know, not only bad experiences, but they also have sexual assault within those early experiences, right? And a lot of that is because of the very demented gender norms that we have in this country that, you know, tell boys, like, push as hard as you can, you're in college now, you don't want to be a virgin, okay, that girl has beer goggles on, well, you should still take her home, right? Because you gotta get it, right? You know, that kind of negative attitude, I mean, I am sorry, but we spend so much time talking about the campus courts, which a teeny, tiny, tiny number of the 22 million college students in America interact with. I mean, just a few thousand cases a year in these campus courts. Yet one in six men in America belongs to a fraternity, okay? And a fraternity is a single-sex social club with a Title IX exemption that, you know, look, there are good fraternities out there. I think there are. I've met those guys.
Hashtag not all fraternities.
Yeah, exactly, right. You know, I don't want to make some sweeping the blanket statement, but I also think there's enough bad ones, right? And every college girl can point out the bad ones on the college campus, and the general notion of them that as universities have become more and more concerned about liability around drinking, they've made it so if you have a keg in your dorm, you're going straight to the disciplinary panel. But they have no problem, universities, with throwing that keg in an unsupervised fraternity basement. You know, and we know that a lot of these sexual assaults are not happening at the fraternity, but they're happening after the fraternity party, after that atmosphere, after those gender norms have really been cemented in people's minds. And I just think that's so obviously the conversation that we need to be having. Harvard, of course, is, you know, on their way to getting rid of these single-sex frats.
Right, right.
And you know, that's what smart people are starting to look at. You know, the social norms and social culture of the campus. How can we change that?
Laura, I want to ask you, and Liz too, I want to ask you a little bit about this sort of Jekyll and Hyde nature of Weinstein. I mean, granted, you know, Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, they're, you know, these are not sympathetic figures, you know, largely to a lot of people because they are conservative. You have Harvey Weinstein, who, you know, ostensibly was a liberal. He was giving to liberal causes, liberal politicians, you know, distributing the Hunting Ground documentary, showing up at the Women's March. What kind of lessons can we take from this sort of performance of feminism versus, obviously, his private behavior?
Well, people are complicated and contradictory. I mean, you've got all this moral grandstanding going on with the pundits now, like who, you know, can be the quickest to label him a sociopath or, you know, this emblem of evil. But, I mean, you know, he's a dimensional person, much as we don't want to acknowledge that, and, you know, had good politics in some way and acted like a, you know, a hideous person in private. So that doesn't seem that surprising to me.
Liz, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I feel like that behavior defies politics, and I think that if you're so embedded in things, you know, it's like we read today that, you know, there was this big claim in conservative media that Harvey Weinstein gave Planned Parenthood $100,000, and that turns out he pledged it, but he never even gave it to begin with. So it's like, oh, wait, that, like, you're even worse. You said you were going to give and you even didn't. So, like, it just adds to the, it ices the garbage cake. But I think for me, I feel like if I'm a person who has politics and I'll call it out everywhere. I don't care if it's Harvey Weinstein, and I don't care if it's Bill Clinton. I don't care if it's Roger Ailes. For me, if you're going to be on the wrong side of expanding the full humanity of women and creating safe spaces for them to exist in the world, you deserve to be called out on it. You just do. I don't reserve that.
I think that's a good place for us to stop. Thank you to our guest, Liz Winstead with Lady Parts Justice League, Vanessa Gregoriadis, author of Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus, and Laura Kipnis. Her book is Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Thank you all. In a moment, there's a new bipartisan call for the U.S. to stop backing the Saudi-led military strikes in the devastated nation of Yemen. That's on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Jamil Smith here with today's Talking Point. Nearly 20 million people have no access to clean drinking water. Hundreds of thousands are stricken with cholera. The small country of Yemen is undergoing a deep humanitarian crisis due to a civil war that barely makes the headlines. And the military assault, led by U.S. ally Saudi Arabia, may also open the door to radicalization in this Mideast nation. That's according to congressmen who are calling for the U.S. to pull out its troops and its support. Mohammed Bazzi is an associate professor of journalism at New York University who writes on the Middle East. Welcome to The Point.
Thank you for having me.
Describe, if you can, Mohammed, what else we know about the current situation in Yemen.
So the war, which began in March of 2015, it's now 2.5 years into this war led by Saudi Arabia, has caused this severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen. We're now on pace to see the most severe cholera outbreak in world history. So since records have been kept in modern times, the World Health Organization is expecting 1 million cholera cases by the end of this year, which would surpass the cholera epidemic in Haiti, the recent epidemic there. We have about 7 million people who are on the verge of starvation. That's according to UN figures. And that's 7 million people out of a population of 28 million. So this is a war that's precipitated a huge humanitarian crisis in a country that was already the poorest Arab country.
Now, how does pulling out U.S. forces from Yemen, Mohammed, square with our huge military connections with that nation? I mean, it clearly funds the bombing and so much else, and we clearly have a tight relationship, at least with the, you know, under this current administration. Like, how can we get out of this without really, you know, making sure that our hands are clean?
So, I'm not sure if the U.S. can entirely get out of this with clean hands, but this bill, this bipartisan bill, is calling on the U.S. to essentially suspend its assistance, its military technical assistance to Saudi Arabia, while it wages the current war in Yemen, until Congress gets more oversight over this war. And so right now there are U.S. military advisors that are helping Saudi Arabia both in refueling its military planes, the planes that are bombing Yemen, and also helping with intelligence and logistical and technical assistance in terms of targets.
Now, are U.S.
that these U.S. advisors are playing on the ground. They're not deployed in Yemen, but they're helping the Saudis.
Gotcha. Okay. You know, is the devastation in Yemen, Mohammed, being forgotten with all the media attention that's being put to, you know, natural disasters, North Korea, Iran, the civil war in Syria? What do Americans need to know about this crisis and why it's particularly unique?
Oh, it is certainly being forgotten with all the other international headlines and all the crises that we're seeing around the world. And certainly internal U.S. politics. I think audiences in the U.S. need to realize that this is a quiet and very devastating war to the population of Yemen, to a country that is the poorest Arab country, and that gets very little attention, except in situations where we have this bill that probably will not pass a vote in the House, but at least it brings some attention to the war in Yemen, to the crisis, and also to the U.S. role, which is not understood very well. This U.S. role of assisting Saudi Arabia and basically helping it wage this war on a daily basis.
How serious are U.S. politicians actually taking this? I mean, you say that the bill is probably not going to pass. And so this is, you know, largely a symbolic gesture, perhaps. Are their hands tied by the relationship with Saudi Arabia? Or is it something else?
That's part of it. Part of it is the very strong U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has become one of the largest purchasers of U.S. weapons, and this did not just start under the current administration. This began under the second Bush administration and intensified under the Obama administration, and now we're seeing more of it under the Trump administration. So that's a significant part of it. Saudi Arabia pumps a lot of money through these weapons purchases into weapons manufacturers in the U.S. That kind of keep certainly some lawmakers, especially ones whose districts have large weapons manufacturers. Those are lawmakers who are unlikely to support this. But this bill is a sign that there is concern about how Saudi Arabia has handled the war. There's concern among members of Congress. And I think as bills like this are introduced and as more public attention is paid to this war and to the effect it's having on the Yemeni people and on this population that's essentially under siege because of the war, I think we might see slowly at least some action. This bill might fail, but maybe another bill will get introduced, and certainly the next time the administration comes to Congress seeking approval for the latest round of weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. at least there'll be material on record, and other lawmakers can speak up about it.
Now, how does Iran factor in, Mohammed? I mean, there's talk of rolling back the nuclear deal. At least Trump is trying to decertify it, and that's obviously connected to a lot of Saudis in the region. Any statements from mm-hmm. the U.S. on that?
So Iran fits in here in several ways. So there's the Saudi-Iran conflict that's defined a lot of what's transpired in the region, certainly over the past decade. And it's this largely political competition for domination of different parts of the region between Saudi Arabia and Iran, each one trying to extend their influence in different parts of the region and often fighting over the same places. Usually they do it through proxies. So in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen. So the major group that the Saudis are fighting in Yemen is a Shiite group called the Houthis. They're a group of rebels who took control of the capital. It's kind of complicated internal Yemeni politics, but sort of briefly, this group had some support from Iran before the war, but now that support is intensified. Iran is more intensely involved with them because they're fighting the Saudis. And so it's become another arena for this proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And the Trump administration has made it clear that it wants to side with Saudi Arabia and help Saudi Arabia in this war.
So, but just theoretically, say the U.S. does pass something like this, this measure that's in, you know, being put forth in Congress right now, how might that, you know, affect the relationship between Americans and the Saudis? And how, what kind of effects, you know, real life effects might that have?
It would certainly, the Saudis would be furious if this measure passed. They would probably threaten to withdraw some of their weapon sales. They would threaten to roll back some of those purchases. They would threaten other kinds of cooperation with the U.S. I mean, in some ways, the Saudis are also boxed into, they've already purchased a lot of U.S. weapons, and they need U.S. help in operating those weapons. This very high technical assistance that the U.S. provides, especially for running the warplanes and targeting assistance and those sorts of things. So the Saudis can make some noise about that, but they are also boxed in the things they've already purchased. Where we might see an impact is if all of this U.S. assistance is pulled away, we would likely see a lot fewer airstrikes in Yemen because the Saudis wouldn't be capable of carrying out the level of airstrikes that they have been carrying out without the refueling assistance from the U.S.
Wow. Well, Mohammed Bazzi of New York University, thank you very much for joining us and helping us understand this better.
Thank you.
PRI, Public Radio International.